as he sprinted toward his circle. He kicked one demon in the back of the knees, knocking it down just long enough for him to get past. Another he charged directly, only to spin out of the way at the last moment, the Corling's claws slashing through empty air. He picked up speed as the circle neared, but one demon stood in his way, and there was no way around it. The creature was nearly 4 feet tall, and its initial confusion was past. It crouched at the ready, directly in his path, hissing hatred. Arlen was so close, his precious circle just a few feet away. He could only hope to barrel through the smaller creature and roll into his circle before it could kill him. He charged right in, instinctively stabbing with his new spear as he bowled the creature over. There was a flash upon impact, and Arlen struck the ground hard, coming up in a spray of sand, and continuing on, not daring to look back. He leapt for his circle and was safe. Panting with exertion, Arlen looked up at the sand demons surrounding him, outlined in desert twilight. They hissed and clawed at his wards, talons bringing bright flashes of magic. In the flickering light, Arlen caught sight of the demon he had crashed into. It was slowly dragging itself away from Arlen and its fellows, leaving an inky black trail in the sand. Arlen's eyes widened. Slowly he glanced down at the spear he still clutched in his hands. The tip was coated in demon ichor. Suppressing the urge to laugh aloud, Arlen looked back at the injured Corling. One by one, its fellows paused in their assault on Arlen's wards, sniffing the air. They turned, glancing down at the trail of ichor, and then at the injured demon. With a shriek, the pack fell upon the creature, tearing it apart. The cold of the desert night eventually forced Arlen to take his eyes off the metal spear. He'd laid a fire when he made camp earlier, so he struck spark to it and coaxed the flames to life, warming himself and a bit of dinner. Dawnrunner had been hobbled and blanketed in his circle, brushed and fed before Arlen left to explore the ruins that afternoon. As it had every night for the last 3 years, one arm showed up soon after moonrise, bounding over the dunes and scattering the smaller Corlings to stand before Arlen's circle. Arlen greeted it as always with a clap of his two hands. One arm roared its hatred in return. When he first left Milne, Arlen had wondered if he would ever find a way to sleep through the sound of one arm hammering at his wards, but it was second nature to him now. His warding circle had been proven time and again, and Arlen maintained it religiously, keeping the plates freshly lacquered and the rope mended. He hated the demon, though. The years had brought none of the kinship the guards on the wall of Fort Milne had felt. As one arm remembered who had crippled it, so too did Arlen recall who had given him the puckered scars across his back and almost cost him his life. He remembered 2 9-warders, 37 guardsmen, 2 messengers, 3 herb-gatherers, and 18 citizens of Milne who had lost their lives because of it. He gazed at the demon now, absently stroking his new spear. What would happen if he struck? The weapon had wounded a sand demon. Would the wards affect a rock demon as well? It took all his willpower to resist the urge to leap from his circle and find out. Arlen had hardly slept when the sun drove the demons back into the core, but he rose with high spirits. After breakfast, he took out his notebook and examined the spear, painstakingly copying every ward and studying the patterns they formed along the shaft and head. When he finished, the sun was high in the sky. Taking another torch, he went back down into the catacombs, making rubbings of the wards cut into the stone. There were other tombs, and he was tempted to ignore all sense and explore every one. But if he stayed even another day, his food would run out before he reached the Oasis of Dawn. He'd gambled on finding a well in the ruins of Anaxun, and indeed he had. but vegetation was scant and inedible. Arlen sighed. The ruins had stood for centuries. They would be there when he returned, hopefully with a team of Krasian warders at his back. By the time he came back outside, the day was wearing on. Arlen took time to exercise and feed Dawnrunner, then prepared a meal for himself, his mind turned inward. The Krasians would demand proof, of course, proof the spear could kill. They were warriors, not ruin hunters, and wouldn't give up a single able-bodied man for an expedition without good reason. Proof, he thought, and it was only right that it come from him. With barely an hour before sunset, Arlen began to ready his camp. He hobbled his horse again, checking the portable circle around it. He prepared his 10-foot circle, as usual, then took a series of ward stones from his bags and began to lay them around it in a wide outer ring some 40 feet in diameter. He placed the stones slightly farther apart than usual, carefully lining them up with their fellows. There was a third portable circle in the saddlebags. Arlen always kept the spare. And he set that one in the camp as well, off to the side in the larger circle by its edge. When he was finished, Arlen knelt in his center circle, the spear at his side, and breathed deeply, clearing his mind of distractions. He didn't watch as the sun dipped and the sand glowed on the horizon before going dark. The nimble sand demons rose first, and Arlen heard the wards of his outer circle spark and crackle, keeping them back. Moments later, he heard the roar of one arm, scattering lesser demons from its path as it approached Arlen's outer ring. Arlen ignored it, continuing to breathe, his eyes closed, his mind calm. The lack of reaction served only to anger the demon further, and it struck hard against the warding. Magic flared, visible even through his closed eyelids, but the demon didn't immediately continue its assault. He opened his eyes, watching one arm cock its head curiously. Arlen allowed himself a humorless smile. One arm struck the wards again, and again it paused. This time the demon let out a piercing cry and set its feet, thrusting its good arm at the warding. Talons spread. As if it were pressing against a wall of glass, the demon leaned forward, shrieking against the pain as it doubled and tripled the pressure against the wards. Angry magic spiderwebbed out from where its claws met the barrier, and as the demon pressed, the magic bowed visibly in the air. With a sound that chilled even Arlen's calm mind, the rock demon flexed its armored legs and smashed through the ward net, tumbling into the inner ring. Dawnrunner whinnied and pulled at its hobble. Arlen rose as one arm did, their eyes meeting. The weaker sand demons tried desperately to replicate one arm's feat, but the ward stones were precisely spaced, and none of them could muster the strength to cross. They shrieked their frustration at the barrier as they bore witness to the confrontation within the circle. Though he had grown since they first met, Arlen felt no less dwarfed by one arm now than he had that first terrifying night. The rock demon stood over 15 feet tall, from its clawed feet to the tips of its horns, more than twice a man's height. Arlen was forced to crane his head upward to meet the calling's eyes, locked unwaveringly on his own. One arm's snout split wide to reveal rows of razor-sharp teeth running with drool, and it flexed its dagger-like talons teasingly. Its armored chest was thrown back, the black carapace impenetrable to known weapons, and its spiked tail whipped back and forth, heavy enough to smash a horse with a single blow. Its body was smoking and scorched from crossing the net, but the obvious hurt only made the calling seem more dangerous, a titan mad with pain. Arlen's fingers tightened on the metal spear as he stepped from the circle. Chapter 18. Rite of Passage. 328 AR. One arm shrieked into the night, its vengeance finally at hand. Arlen forced himself to breathe deeply, fighting to keep his heart from pounding right out of his chest. Even if the magic of the spear could harm the demon, and he had nothing more than his hopes that it could, it wouldn't be enough to win this battle. He needed all his wits about him, all his training. His feet slowly slid apart into a battle stance. The sand would slow him, but it would slow one arm as well. He kept eye contact and made no sudden moves as the corling savored the moment. Its reach far exceeded his own, even with the spear. Let it come to him. Arlen felt as if his entire life had been rushing toward this moment without his ever realizing it. He wasn't sure if he was ready for this test, but after being hounded by this demon for more than 10 years, he found the thought of putting it off any longer intolerable. Even now, he could step back into the protective circle, safe from the rock demon's attacks. Deliberately, he moved away from it, committing himself to the contest. One arm watched him circle, its muzzle curling in a snarl. A low rumbling echoed in the corling's throat. Its tail flicked faster, and Arlen knew it was getting ready to strike. With a roar, the demon lunged, its talons splayed as they cut the air. Arlen darted straight forward, ducking the blow and moving inside the corling's reach. He kept on, going right between its legs, stabbing his spear into its tail as he rolled aside. There was a satisfying flash of magic as he struck, and the demon howled as the weapon broke through its armor and pierced flesh. Arlen was expecting return slash of the demon's tail, but it came quicker than he anticipated. He threw himself flat to the ground as the appendage whooshed by, the spikes inches from his head. He was up again in a flash, but one arm was already turning, using its tail's momentum to speed its pivot. For all its size, the corling was agile and quick. One arm struck again, and Arlen couldn't dodge in time. He whipped the shaft of his spear perpendicular to the blow in parry, but he knew the demon was far too powerful to block. He had let his emotions get the better of him. He had entered this contest too soon. He cursed himself for a fool. But as the demon's talons struck the metal of the spear, the wards etched along its length flared. Arlen hardly felt the blow, but one arm was deflected as if it had struck a warded circle. The demon was thrown back as its own power rebounded, but it recovered fast, unharmed. Arlen forced himself to overcome his shock and move, understanding the blessing for what it was, and determined to make the most of it. One arm charged him madly, determined to power through this new obstacle. Scattering sand as he ran, Arlen vaulted the fallen remains of a thick stone pillar, taking shelter behind it, and preparing to dodge left or right, depending on how the demon approached. One arm struck hard at the pillar, almost 4 feet in diameter, and broke it in half, throwing one side out of its way with a flex of its sinewy arm. The raw display of power was terrifying, and Arlen bolted for his circle, needing a moment to recover. The demon anticipated his reaction, though, and its legs twitched, launching it into the air. It landed in between Arlen and his sucker. Arlen stopped short, and one arm again shrieked in triumph. It had tested Arlen's mettle and found him wanting. It respected the spear's bite, but there was no fear in the corling's eyes as it advanced. Arlen gave ground slowly, deliberately, not wanting to provoke the creature with a sudden move. He backed up as far as he could before crossing his outer ward stones and coming into the reach of the sand demons clustered to watch the battle. Monarm saw his predicament and roared, its thunderous charge terrible to behold. Arlen set himself firmly, his legs coiled. He didn't bother to raise the spear to block. Instead, he cocked it back, ready to stab. The rock demon's blow was powerful enough to crush a lion's skull, but it never struck home. Arlen had allowed the demon to back him into his spare portable circle, unnoticed in the sand. The wards flared to life, reflecting the demon's attack back on it, and Arlan was ready, leaping forward and skewering the demon in the belly with his warded spear. Munarm's shriek pierced the night, a deafening, horrifying sound. To Arlan, it was like music. He pulled back on the spear, but it held fast, caught in the rock demon's thick black carapace. He yanked again, and this time it nearly cost him his life, as one arm lashed out and struck him a glancing blow, its claws digging deep into his shoulder and chest. Arlan was sent spinning away, but he wrenched himself toward his spare circle, collapsing in the protective ring. As he clutched his wounds, he watched the giant rock demon stumble about. Again and again, one arm attempted to grasp the spear and pull it free of the wound, but the wards along its length thwarted the demon, and all along the magic continued to work, sparking in the wound and sending killing waves through the Corling's body. Arlan allowed himself a slight smile as one arm collapsed to the ground, thrashing. But as he watched the demon's flailing, slow to twitching, he felt a great emptiness grow inside of him. He had dreamt of this moment countless times, of how it would feel, of what he would say, but it wasn't like he imagined. Instead of elation, he felt depression and loss. "That was for you, ma'am," he whispered, as the great demon ceased to move. He tried to picture her, desperate to feel her approval, and he was shocked and ashamed when he couldn't remember her face. He screamed, feeling wretched and small under the stars. Giving the demon a wide berth, Arlan made his way back to his supplies, binding his wounds. The stitches he made were crooked, but they held his wounds closed, and the Hogroot poultice burned, the pain evidence of its need. Already the wound was infecting. He found no sleep that night. If the pain of his wounds and the ache of his heart hadn't been sufficient to drive slumber away, a chapter of his life was about to end, and he was determined to see it through. When the sun crested the dunes, it flooded Arlan's camp with a speed that could only be found in the desert. The sand demons had already melted away, fleeing at the first hint of dawn. Arlan winced as he stood up, making his way from the circle to stand over one arm, retrieving his spear. Wherever the sun's light touched, the black carapace smoked and sparked and ignited. Soon the demon's body was a funeral pyre, and Arlan stood watching, mesmerized. As the rock demon collapsed into ashes, soon borne on the morning wind, he saw hope for the human race. Chapter 19. The First Warrior of Krasia, 328 AR. The desert road wasn't really a road at all, simply a string of ancient signposts, some clawed and jagged, others half buried in sand, keeping a traveler from losing his way. It wasn't all sand, as Reagan had once said, though there was enough of that to wander for days, seeing naught else. On the outskirts ran hundreds of miles of hard, dust-choked flats, with sparse bits of dead vegetation clinging to cracked clay, too dry to rot. Apart from the shadows cast by dunes in the sea of sand, there was no shelter from the beating sun. So hot, Arlan couldn't imagine it was the same body that brought cold light to Fort Milne. The wind blew continually, and he had to cover his face to keep from inhaling sand, his throat raw and dry. The nights were worse, the heat leaching from the ground moments after the sun dipped below the horizon, welcoming the Corlings into a cold, desolate place. But even here there was life. Snakes and lizards hunted tiny rodents. Carrion birds sought the corpses of creatures slain by Corlings, or that wandered into the desert and couldn't find their way back out. There were at least two large oases, where a large body of water caused the surrounding soil to grow dense with edible vegetation, and others were a trickle from the rock or a pool of water no wider than a man's stride, supported a host of stunted plants and small creatures. Arlen had witnessed these desert dwellers burying themselves in the sand at night, resisting the cold with conserved heat and hiding from the demons that stalked the sands. There were no rock demons in the desert, for there wasn't enough prey. No flame demons, because there was little to burn. Wood demons had no bark to blend into, no limbs to climb. Water demons couldn't swim through sand, and wind demons could find no perch. The dunes and desert flats belonged to sand demons alone. Even they were sparse in the deep desert, clustering mostly about the oases, but the sight of a fire would draw them for miles around. 5 weeks from Fort Risen to Crasia, more than half of it through the desert, was more than many of the hardiest messengers cared to contemplate. Despite northern merchants offering exorbitant sums for Crasian silks and spice, few were desperate or crazy enough to go there. For his own part, Arlen found the trip peaceful. He slept in the saddle during the hottest parts of the day, carefully wrapped in loose white cloth. He watered his horse frequently and spread tarps beneath his portable circles at night to keep the wards from becoming obscured in the sand. He was tempted to lash out at the circling sand demons, but his wound had made his grip weak, and he knew that should the spear be pulled from his grasp, a common wind might lose it in the sand more surely than hundreds of years in a buried tomb. Despite the cries of the sand demons, the nights seemed quiet to Arlen, used to the great roars of One Arm. He slept more peacefully on those nights than any spent outside before. For the first time in his life, Arlen saw his path extend beyond being a glorified errand boy. He had always known he was destined for more than messaging. He was destined to fight. But he now realized it was more than that. He was destined to bring others to fight. He was certain he could duplicate the warded spear, and was already pondering ways to adapt its wards to other weapons. Arrows, staves, slingstones. The possibilities were endless. In all the places he had seen, only the Crasians refused to live in terror of the Corlings, and for that reason Arlen respected them above all. There were no people more deserving of this gift. He would show them the spear, and they would supply him with everything he needed to build them weapons to turn the tide of their nightly war. The thoughts fled as Arlen caught sight of the oasis. The sand could reflect the sky's blue and trick a man into rushing off the road to water that didn't exist, but when his horse picked up the pace, Arlen knew it was real. Dawnrunner could smell the water. Their water had been depleted the day before, and by the time they reached the small pool, both Arlen and his horse were sick with thirst. In unison, they dropped their heads to the cool water, drinking deeply. When they had drunk their fill, Arlen refilled their water skins and set them in the shade beneath one of the sandstone monoliths standing silent guard around the oasis. He inspected the wards cut into the stone, finding them intact, but with some signs of wear. The eternally blowing sand scratched at them little by little, wearing down the edges over time. He took out his etching tools, deepening and sharpening them to maintain the net. While Dawnrunner grazed on scrub grass and the leaves of stunted bushes, Arlen harvested dates, figs, and other fruit from the oasis trees. He ate his fill and set the rest where they could dry in the sun. An underground river fed the oasis, and in years beyond memory, men had dug away the sand and cut the stone beneath, finally reaching the running water. Arlen descended the stone steps into a cool underground chamber and collected the nets stored there, tossing them into the water. When he left, he carried a satisfying catch of fish. He set aside a choice few for himself and cleaned the others, salting them and setting them alongside the fruit to dry. Taking a forked tool from the oasis stores, He then searched around the stones, at last spotting telltale grooves in the sand. Soon he had a snake pinned with the forked stick, and snatched it by the tail, cracking it like a whip to kill it. There was likely a cache of eggs nearby, but he didn't search them out. It would be dishonorable to deplete the oasis more than necessary. Again, he put part of the snake aside for his own uses, and set the rest to dry. In a carved nook in one of the great sandstones, marked with the sigils of many messengers, Arlen retrieved a cache of tough, dried fruits, fish, and meat left by the previous messenger, and refilled his saddlebags. Once his harvest dried, he would replenish the nook for the next messenger to succor here. It was impossible to cross the desert without stopping at the Oasis of Dawn. The only source of water for over 100 miles, it was the destination of every desert traveler in either direction. Most of these were messengers, and therefore warders, and over the years that exclusive society had marked their passing on the abundant sandstone. Dozens of names were cut into the stones. Some were simply scratched print, while others were masterworks of calligraphy. Many messengers included more than just their names, listing the cities they had visited, or the number of times they had succored at the Oasis of Dawn. On his 11th trip through the oasis, Arlen had long since finished carving his name and those of the living cities and villages he had visited, but he never stopped exploring, and always had something to add. Slowly, using beautiful scrolling letters, Arlen reverently inscribed "Anaxoon" into the list of ruins he had seen. No other messenger's mark in the oasis made such a claim, and that filled him with pride. The next day, Arlen continued to increase the oasis stores. It was a matter of honor among messengers to leave the oasis stocked better than it was found, against the day when one of their number should stumble in too injured or sunstruck to gather for themselves. That night, he composed a letter to Cobb. He had written many such. They sat in his saddlebag, unsent. His words always felt inadequate to make up for abandoning his duties, but this news was too great not to share. He illustrated the wards on the spear's tip precisely, knowing Cobb could spread the knowledge to every warder in Milne in short order. He left the Oasis of Dawn first thing next morning, heading southwest. For 5 days he saw little more than yellow dunes and sand demons, but early on the 6th, the city of Fort Crasia, the Desert Spear, came into view, framed by the mountains beyond. From afar it seemed just another dune, sandstone walls blending with the surroundings. It was built around an oasis much larger than the Oasis of Dawn, fed, the ancient map said, by the same great underground river. Its warded walls, carved rather than painted, stood proudly in the sun. High above the city flew Crasia's banner, crossed spears over a rising sun. The guards at the gate wore the black robes of Dal Shabrum, the Crasian warrior caste, veiled against the ruthless sand. While not as tall as Milnese, Crasians were a head taller than most Angerians or Lactonians, hard with wiry muscle. Arlen nodded to them as he passed. The guards raised their spears in return. Among Crasian men this was the barest courtesy, but Arlen had worked hard to earn the gesture. In Crasia, a man was judged by the number of scars he carried, and allegi, corlings, he had killed. Outsiders, or chin, as the Crasians called them, even messengers were considered cowards who had given up the fight, and were unworthy of any courtesy from Dal Shabrum. The word chin was an insult. But Arlen had shocked the Crasians with his requests to fight alongside them, and after he had taught their warriors new wards and assisted in many kills, they now called him Par Chin, which meant brave outsider. He would never be considered an equal, but the Dal Shabrum had stopped spitting at his feet, and he had even made a few true friends. Through the gate, Arlen entered the maze, a wide inner yard before the wall of the city proper, filled with walls, trenches, and pits. Each night, their families locked safe behind the inner walls. But Dal Shaarum engaged in Alagai Shirak, holy war against demonkind. They lured Korlings into the maze, ambushing and harrying them into warded pits to await the sun. Casualties were high, but Krasians believed that dying in Alagai Shirak assured them a place at the side of Everim, the Creator, and went gladly into the killing zone. Soon, Arlan thought, it will be only Korlings that die here. Just inside the main gate was the great bazaar, where merchants hawked over hundreds of laden carts, the air thick with hot Krasian spices, incense, and exotic perfumes. Rugs, bolts of fine cloth, and beautiful painted pottery sat beside mounds of fruit and bleating livestock. It was a noisy and crowded place, filled with shouted haggling. Every other marketplace Arlan had ever seen teemed with men, but the great bazaar of Krasia was filled almost entirely with women, covered head to toe in thick black cloth. They bustled about, selling and buying, shouting at each other vigorously, and handing over their worn golden coins only grudgingly. Jewelry and bright cloth was sold in abundance in the bazaar, but Arlan had never seen it worn. Men had told him the women wore the adornments under their black, but only their husbands knew for sure. Krasian men above the age of 16 were almost all warriors. A small few were Dama, the holy men who were also Krasia's secular leaders. No other vocation was considered honorable. Those who took a craft were called kafit and considered contemptible, barely above women in Krasian society. The women did all the day-to-day work in the city, from farming and cooking to child care. They dug clay and made pottery, built and repaired homes, trained and slaughtered animals, and haggled in the markets. In short, they did everything but fight. Yet despite their unending labor, they were utterly subservient to the men. A man's wives and unmarried daughters were his property, and he could do with them as he pleased, even kill them. A man could take many wives, but if a woman so much as let a man who was not her husband look at her unveiled, she could, and often would, be put to death. Krasian women were considered expendable. Men weren't. Without their women, Arlan knew, the Krasian men would be lost. But the women treated men in general with reverence, and their husbands with near worship. They came each morning to find the dead from the night's Alagai Shirak, and wailed over the bodies of their men, collecting their precious tears in tiny vials. Water was coin in Krasia, and a warrior's status in life could be measured by the number of tear bottles filled upon his death. If a man was killed, it was expected that his brothers or friends would take his wives, so they would always have a man to serve. Once in the maze, Arlan had held a dying warrior who offered him his three wives. "They are beautiful, Parchin," he had assured, "and fertile. They will give you many sons. Promise you will take them." Arlan promised they would be cared for, and then found another willing to take them on. He was curious about what lay under the Krasian women's robes, but not enough to trade his portable circle for a clay building, his freedom for a family. Following behind almost every woman were several tan-clad children. The girls' hair wrapped, the boys' in rag caps. As early as 11, the girls would begin to marry and take on the black clothes of women, while the boys were taken to the training grounds even younger. Most would take on the black robes of Dal Shaarum. Some few would come to wear the white of Dama and devote their lives to serving Everim. Those who failed at both professions would be kafit and wear tan in shame until they died. The women caught sight of Arlan as he rode through the market and began whispering to one another excitedly. He watched them, amused. The none would look him in the eye or approach him. They hungered for the goods in his saddlebags. Fine Rhizonian wool, Milanese jewels, Angerian paper, and other treasures of the north. but he was a man, and worse, a chin, and they dared not approach. The eyes of the Dhamma were everywhere. "Pachin!" a familiar voice called, and Arlen turned to see his friend Aben approach, the fat merchant limping and leaning heavily on his crutch. Lame since childhood, Aben was kafit, unable to stand among the warriors, and unworthy to be a holy man. He had done well for himself, though, doing trade with messengers from the north. He was clean-shaven and wore the tan cap and shirt of kafit, but over that he wore a rich headcloth, vest, and pantaloons of bright silk, stitched in many colors. He claimed his wines were as beautiful as those of any Dal Sharam. "By Avaram, it is good to see you, son of Jeff," Aben called in flawless Thesan, slapping Arlen on the shoulder. "The sun always shines brighter when you grace our city." Arlen wished he had never told the merchant his father's name. In Krasia, the name of a man's father was more important than one's own. He wondered what they would think if they knew his father was a coward. But he clapped Aben on the shoulder in return, his smile genuine. "And you, my friend," he said. He would never have mastered the Krasian tongue, or learned to navigate its strange and often dangerous culture without the lame merchant's aid. "Come, come," Aben said. "Rest your feet in my shade and wash the dust from your throat with my water." He led Arlen to a bright and colorful tent pitched behind his carts in the bazaar. He clapped his hands, and his wives and daughters, Arlen could never tell the difference, scurried to open the flaps and tend the dawn runner. Arlen had to force himself not to help as they took the heavily laden saddlebags and carried them into the tent, knowing that the Krasians found the sight of a man laboring unseemly. One of the women reached for the warded spear, wrapped in cloth and slung from his saddle horn, but Arlen snatched it away before she could touch it. She bowed deeply, afraid she'd given some insult. The inside of the tent was filled with colorful silk pillows and intricately woven carpets. Arlen left his dusty boots by the flap and breathed deeply of the cool, scented air. He eased down onto the pillows on the floor as Aben's women knelt before him with water and fruit. When he was refreshed, Aben clapped his hands and the women brought them tea and honeyed pastries. "Your trip through the desert passed well?" Aben asked. "Oh yes," Arlen smiled. "Very well indeed." They made small talk for some time afterward. Aben never failed in this formality, but his eyes kept flicking to Arlen's saddlebags, and he rubbed his hands together absently. "To business, then?" Arlen asked, as soon as he judged it polite. "Of course, the Parchin is a busy man," Aben agreed, snapping his fingers. The women quickly brought out an array of spices, perfume, silks, jewelry, rugs, and other Krasian craft. Aben examined the goods from Arlen's clients in the north, while Arlen perused the items proposed for trade. Aben found fault with everything, scowling. "You crossed the desert just to trade this lot?" he asked in disgust when he was done. "It hardly seems worth the trip." Arlen hid his grin as they sat and were served fresh tea. Bidding always started this way. "Nonsense," he replied. "A blind man could see I have brought some of the finest treasures Thesa has to offer. Better by far than the sorry goods your women have brought before me. I hope you have more hidden away, because..." He fingered one carpet, a masterwork of weaving. "I've seen better carpets rotting in ruins." "You wound me," Aben cried. "I, who give you water and shade? Woe am I that a guest in my tent should treat me so," he lamented. "My wives worked the loom day and night to make that, using only the finest wool. A better carpet you will never see." After that it was only a matter of haggling, and Arlen hadn't forgotten the lessons learned watching old Hogg and Reagan a lifetime ago. As always, the session ended with both men acting as if they had been robbed, but inwardly feeling they had gotten the better of the other. "My daughters will pack up your goods and hold them for your departure," Aben said at last. "Will you sup with us tonight? My wives prepare a table none in your north can match." Arlen shook his head regretfully. "I go to fight tonight," he said. Aubyn shook his head. "I fear you have learned our ways too well, Parchin. You seek the same death." Arlen shook his head. "I have no intent to die, and expect no paradise in the next life." "Ah, my friend, no one intends to go to Everam in the flower of their youth. But that is the fate that awaits those who go to Alagai Shirak. I can recall a time when there were as many of us as there are grains of sand in the desert. But now..." He shook his head sadly. "The city is practically empty. We keep the bellies of our wives fat with children, but still more die in the night than are born in the day. If we don't change our ways, a decade from now, Krasia will be consumed by the sand." "What if I told you I had come to change that?" Arlen asked.
"The son of Jeff's heart is true," Aubyn said. "But the Damaji will not listen to you. Everam demands war, they say, and no chin is going to change their minds."
The Damaji were the city's ruling council, made up of the highest-ranking Dama of each of the 12 Krasian tribes. They served the Andra, Everam's most favored Dama, whose word was absolute. Arlen smiled. "I can't turn them from Alagai Shirak," he agreed, "but I can help them win it." He uncovered his spear and held it out to Aubyn. Aubyn's eyes widened slightly at the sight of the magnificent weapon, but he raised his palm and shook his head. "I am Kafit, Parchin. The spear is forbidden to my unclean touch." Arlen drew the weapon back and bowed low in apology. "I meant no offense," he said.
"Ha!" Aubyn laughed. "You may be the only man ever to bow to me. Even the Parchin need not fear offending Kafit."
Arlen scowled. "You're a man like any other," he said.
"With that attitude, you will ever be Chin," Aubyn said, but he smiled. "You're not the first man to ward a spear," he said. "Without the combat wards of old, it makes no difference."
"They are the wards of old," Arlen said. "I found this in the ruins of Anaxun." Aubyn blanched.
"You found the lost city?" he asked. "The map was accurate?"
"Why do you sound so surprised?" Arlen asked. "I thought you said it was guaranteed." Aubyn coughed.
"Yes, well," he said, "I trusted our source, of course, but no one has been there in more than 300 years. Who's to say how accurate the map was?"
He smiled.
"Besides, it's not like you were likely to come back for a refund if I was wrong."
They both laughed.
"By Everam, it is a fine tale, Parchin," Aubyn said when Arlen finished describing his adventure in the Lost City. "But if you value your life, you will not tell the Damaji that you looted the holy city of Anaxun."
"I won't," Arlen promised. "But surely they'll see the value in the spear regardless." Aubyn shook his head.
"Even if they agree to grant you audience, Parchin," he said, "and I doubt they will, they will refuse to see value in anything a chin brings them."
"You may be right," Arlen said, "but I should at least try. I have messages to deliver to the Andra's palace anyway. Walk with me." Aubyn held up his crutch.
"It's a long way to the palace, Parchin," he said.
"I'll walk slowly," Arlen said, knowing the crutch had nothing to do with the refusal.
"You don't want to be seen with me outside the market, my friend," Aubyn warned. "That alone may cost you the respect you've earned in the maze."
"Then I'll earn more," Arlen said. "What good is respect if I can't walk with my friend?" Aubyn bowed deeply.
"One day," he said, "I wish to see the land that makes noble men like the son of Jeff."
Arlen smiled. "When that day comes, Aubyn, I will take you across the desert myself." Abin grabbed Arlen's arm.
"Stop walking," he ordered.
Arlen obeyed, trusting in his friend, though he saw nothing amiss. Women walked the street carrying heavy loads, and a group of Dal Shuram walked ahead of them. Another group was approaching from the other direction. Each was led by a Dama in white robes.
"Khajiit tribe," Abin said, pointing with his chin at the warriors ahead of them. "The others are Maja. It would be best for us to wait here a bit."
Arlen squinted at the two groups. Both were clad in the same black, and their spears were simple and unadorned.
"How can you tell the difference?" he asked.
Abin shrugged.
"How can you not?" he replied.
As they watched, one of the Dama called something to the other. They faced off and began to argue.
"What do you suppose they're arguing about?" Arlen asked.
"Always the same thing," Abin said. "The Khajiit Dama believe sand demons reside on the third layer of hell, and the wind demons on the fourth. The Maja say the opposite. The Avija is vague on the point," he added, referring to the Krasian holy canon.
"What difference does that make?" Arlen asked.
"Those on the lower levels are furthest from Evaram's sight," Abin said, "and should be killed first."
The Dama was screaming now, and the Dal Shuram on either side were clenching their spears in rage, ready to defend their leaders.
"They'll fight one another over which demons to kill first?" Arlen asked, incredulous.
Abin spat in the dust.
"The Khajiit will fight the Maja over far less, Parchin."
"But there will be real enemies to fight once the sun sets," Arlen protested.
Abin nodded.
"And when it does, the Khajiit and Maja will stand united," he said. "As we say, by night my enemy becomes my brother. But sunset is still hours away."
One of the Khajiit Dal Shuram struck a Maja warrior across the face with the butt of his spear, knocking the man down. In seconds, all the warriors on each side were locked in combat. Their Dama stood off to the side, unconcerned by and uninvolved in the violence, continuing to shout at one another.
"Why is this tolerated?" Arlen asked. "Can't the Andra forbid it?"
Abin shook his head.
"The Andra is supposed to be of all tribes and none, but in truth, he will always favor the tribe he was raised from. And even if he didn't, not even he can end every blood feud in Krasia. You can't forbid men from being men."
"Well, they're acting more like children," Arlen said.
"The Dal Shuram know only the spear, and the Dama the Avija,"
Abin agreed sadly. The men weren't using the points of their weapons, yet, but the violence was escalating quickly. If someone didn't intervene, there would surely be death.
"Don't even think about it," Abin said, gripping Arlen's arm as he started forward.
Arlen turned to argue, but his friend, looking over his shoulder, gasped and fell to one knee. He yanked on Arlen's arm to do the same.
"Kneel if you value your hide," he hissed.
Arlen looked around, spotting the source of Abin's fear. A woman walked down the road, swathed in holy white.
"Damating," he murmured.
The mysterious herb-gatherers of Krasia was seldom seen. He cast his eyes down as she passed, but didn't kneel. It made no difference. She took no notice of either of them, proceeding serenely toward the melee, unnoticed until she was almost upon the men. The Dama blanched when they saw her, shouting something to their men. At once the fighting stopped, and the warriors fell over themselves to clear a path for the Damating to pass. The warriors and Dama quickly dispersed in her wake, and traffic on the road resumed as if nothing out of the ordinary had happened.
"Are you brave, Parchin, or mad?" Abin asked when she was gone.
"Since when do men kneel to women?" Arlen asked, perplexed.
"Men don't kneel to Damating, but Kafit and Chin do if they're wise," Abin said. "Even the Dama and Dal Shuram fear them. It's said they see the future, knowing which men will live through the night and which will die."
Arlen shrugged. "So what if they do?" he asked, clearly doubtful. Adama Ting had cast his fortune the first night he had gone into the maze, but there'd been nothing about the experience to make him believe she could actually see the future.
"To offend Adama Ting is to offend fate," Aben said, as if Arlen were a fool.
Arlen shook his head. "We make our own fates," he said, "even if the Adama Ting can cast their bones and see them in advance."
"Well, I don't envy the fate you will make if you offend one," Aben said.
They resumed walking and soon reached the Andra's palace, an enormous domed structure of white stone that was likely as old as the city itself. Its wards were painted in gold and glittered in the bright sunlight that fell upon its great spires. But they hadn't set foot on the palace steps before Adama came rushing down to them.
"Begone, Kafit!" he shouted.
"So sorry," Aben apologized, bowing deeply, eyes on the ground, and backed away. Arlen stood his ground. "I am Arlen, son of Jeff, messenger from the north known as Parchin," he said in Krasian. He planted his spear on the ground, and even wrapped, it was clear what it was. "I bring letters and gifts for the Andra and his ministers," Arlen went on, holding up his satchel.
"You keep poor company for one who speaks our tongue, northerner," the Dama said, still scowling at Aben, who groveled in the dust.
An angry retort came to Arlen's lips, but he bit it back.
"The Parchin needed directions," Aben said to the dirt. "I only sought to guide..."
"I didn't ask you to speak, Kafit," the Dama shouted, kicking Aben hard in the side. Arlen's muscles bunched, but a warning glare from his friend kept him in place. The Dama turned back as if nothing had happened.
"I will take your messages," he said.
"The Duke of Ryzen asked that I deliver a gift to the Damaji personally," Arlen dared.
"Not in this life will I let a Chin and a Kafit enter the palace," the Dama scoffed.
The response was disappointing, but not unexpected. Arlen had never managed to see a Damaji. He handed over his letters and packages, scowling as the Dama ascended the steps.
"I'm sorry to say I told you so, my friend," Aben said. "It didn't help that I was with you, but I speak true that the Damaji wouldn't suffer an outsider in their presence, even if he was the Duke of your Ryzen himself. You would have been politely asked to wait and left forgotten on some silk pillow to lose face."
Arlen gritted his teeth. He wondered what Reagan had done when he visited the Desert Spear. Had his mentor tolerated such handling?
"Now will you sup with me?" Aben asked. "I have a daughter, just 15 and beautiful. She would make you a good wife in the north, keeping your home for you while you travel."
What home? Arlen wondered, thinking of the tiny apartment full of books in Fort Angiers that he hadn't been to in over a year. He looked at Aben, knowing his scheming friend was more interested in the trade contacts he could make with a daughter in the north than in her happiness or the upkeep of Arlen's home, in any event.
"You honor me, my friend," he replied, "but I'm not ready to quit just yet."
"No, I rather thought not," Aben sighed. "I suppose you will go see him."
"Yes," Arlen said. "He is no more tolerant of my presence than the Dama," Aben warned.
"He knows your value," Arlen disagreed. Aben shook his head.
"He tolerates my existence because of you," he said. "The Sharam Ka has wanted lessons in the northern tongue ever since you were first allowed into the maze."
"And Aben is the only man in Krasia who knows it," Arlen said, "making him valuable to the first warrior, despite being Kafit." Aben bowed, but looked unconvinced. They headed for the training grounds located not far from the palace. The city center was neutral territory for all tribes, where they gathered to worship and prepare for Alagai Sharak. It was late afternoon, and the camp bustled with activity. Arlen and Aben passed first through the workshops of the weaponsmiths and warders, whose crafts were the only ones considered worthy of Dalsharum, Beyond that stood the open grounds, where drill masters shouted and men trained. On the far side was the palace of the Sharam Ka and his lieutenants. The Kai Sharam. Second only to the immense palace of the Andra, this great dome housed the most honored of all, men who had proved their valor on the battlefield time and time again. Below the palace was said to be a great harem, where they might pass on their brave blood to future generations. There were stares and muttered curses as Aben limped by on his crutch, but none dared bar their way. Aben was under the protection of the Sharam Ka. They passed lines of men doing spear forms in lockstep, and others practicing the brutal, efficient movements of Sharusak, Krasian hand combat. Warriors practiced marksmanship or threw nets at running spear boys, honing their skills for the night's coming battle. Deep in the midst of this was a great pavilion, where they found Jardir going over plans with one of his men. Amun Asu Hoshkamen Amjardir was the Sharam Ka of Krasia, a title that translated into Thesian as First Warrior. He was a tall man, well over 6 feet, wrapped in black cloth and wearing a white turban. In some way Arlen didn't fully understand. The title Sharam Ka was a religious one as well, signified by the turban. His skin was a deep copper color, his eyes dark as his black hair, oiled back and hanging down his neck. His black beard was forked and impeccably trimmed, but there was nothing soft about the man. He moved like a raptor, swift and sure, and his wide sleeves were rolled back to reveal hard, muscular arms crisscrossed with scars. He wasn't much past 30. One of the pavilion guards caught sight of Arlen and Aben as they approached, and bent to whisper in Jardir's ear. The first warrior turned from the chalked slate he was studying. "Parchin," he called, spreading his arms with a smile and rising to meet them. "Welcome back to the Desert Spear." He spoke in Thesian, his vocabulary and accent much improved since Arlen's last visit. He caught Arlen in a firm embrace and kissed his cheeks. "I didn't know you had returned. The Alagai will quail in fear tonight." Upon his first visit to Krasia, the first warrior had taken an interest in Arlen as an oddity, if nothing more. But they had bled for one another in the maze, and in Krasia that meant everything. Jardir turned to Aben. "What are you doing here among men, Kafit?" he asked disgustedly. "I haven't summoned you."
"He's with me," Arlen said.
"He was with you," Jardir said pointedly. Aben bowed deeply and scurried off as quickly as his lame leg would allow. "I don't know why you waste your time with that Kafit, Parchin," Jardir spat. "Where I come from, a man's worth doesn't end with lifting the spear," Arlen said. Jardir laughed. "Where you come from, Parchin, they don't lift the spear at all."
"Your Thesian is much improved," Arlen noted.
Jardir grunted. "Your chin tongue isn't easy, and twice as hard for needing a kafit to practice it when you're away." He watched Aben limp away, sneering at his bright silks. "Look at that one. He dresses like a woman." Arlen glanced across the yard at a black-swathed woman carrying water.
"I've never seen a woman dressed like that," he said.
"Only because you won't let me find you a wife whose veils you can lift," Jardir grinned.
"I doubt the Dama would allow one of your women to marry a tribeless chin," Arlen said.
Jardir waved his hand. "Nonsense," he said. "We have shed blood together in the maze, my brother. If I take you into my tribe, not even the Andra himself would dare protest." Arlen wasn't so sure about that, but he knew better than to argue. Krasians had a way of becoming violent if you challenged their boasts. And it might even be so. Jardir seemed equal to a Damaji, at least. Warriors obeyed him without question, even over their Dama. But Arlen had no desire to join Jardir's tribe or any other. He made the Krasians uncomfortable. A Chin who practiced Alagan Sharak and yet kept company with Kafit. Joining a tribe would ease